I'm Beth Golay, and this is Marginalia. Eradication, a Fable by Jonathan Miles, tells the story of Audie, a man who accepts a job that's described as a way to save the world. More specifically, he's tasked with saving endangered flora and fauna on an island from an invasive goat population. This is a fable, so at the very least, you can expect our main character to experience a moral struggle with his new role. But this is also Jonathan Miles, so you can expect so much more. Here's our conversation. So I am not spoiling anything for our listeners. Would you give us a brief description of Eradication? Is a spoiler-free setup possible?
Yeah, we could probably figure it out. It's the story of a one-time jazz clarinetist and fourth grade teacher whose life has been gutted by a grievous loss and its after effects. And you know, what he's seeking when we meet him is what used to be called respair. It's an archaic term for recovery from despair or the resumption of hope. And he notices a job listing advertising an opportunity to, quote, save the world, and decides that maybe that's his path to respair. The saving the world actually turns out to be a very tiny speck of the world, a remote uninhabited island in the Pacific called Santa Flora. And more than a century ago, whalers dumped goats on the island as a way of stashing protein for their, you know, fresh protein for their return voyages. Of course, the whalers disappeared, but the goats did not. And in the intervening years, they nibbled the once verdant island down to scrawny shrubs, thereby endangering a host of endemic bird, plant, and reptile species. So the job that Audie accepts is to remove the goats from the island and restore it to its Edenic state.
So where did this idea begin for you?
So this idea was seeded about 20 years ago. I was a magazine journalist for years, and I was on assignment in the Galapagos Islands, embedded with the Ecuadorian Navy on their patrols against illegal shark fishing in the islands. And while I was there, I happened to hear about goat eradication efforts that were happening on some of the islands there. And as I described in my fictional island, feral goats had been left on the island and were really ripping up the habitat for the native tortoises that needed the trees for food and shelter. And so what the government was doing was sending in people with rifles to shoot and kill every goat on the island. And I found myself haunted by the moral friction of that, the friction of a righteous and defensible ecological goal meeting the mass slaughter of another species, you know, taking lives to save lives. And I guess the novelist in me started wondering what that would feel like on the individual scale, right? How would a single human being, let's say, you know, one who's had a rifle in his hands, reconcile that? You know, when is killing righteous? Who gets to decide? The musician and painter Terry Allen once said the shortest distance between two questions is art. So about 20 years later, I started writing.
Let's talk about Audie a little bit deeper for a moment, because he's drawn to this idea of saving the world, or at least a piece of it. We know that Audie lived in the capital and did not have much experience outside of the city. He described a sunset on the boat ride to the island as gorgeous and streaky, like some big budget advertisement for divinity. Let's talk about him on just a slightly deeper level and why Santa Flora would appeal to him.
Well, Audie is, like most of us, unfamiliar with the act of voluntarily taking a life, right? He's an urbanite. He's an apartment dweller. He's a habitué of jazz clubs and classrooms. He's never even had a pet. The non-human world is completely alien to him. You know, he finds himself a stranger in a strange land. As to his motivation, he is initially attracted by the idea of this job before he knows what it entails. That is advertising 5 weeks of remote solo work on an island. I think he thinks of it as kind of a potentially, monkish refuge where he can heal. But I also think he's attracted to the idea of salvation, of saving something. Without spoiling what has happened in his past, he was unable to save the person he lost. And I think he wants to try to save something.
The book has sort of a Robinson-esque feel to it, doesn't it? I mean, except for the fact that Audie chose to go there, has a date when he will be picked up, and possesses a satellite phone for emergency extraction. But there's still something a little appealing about marooning oneself for a while, isn't there?
Yeah, I mean, he is not technically marooned, but I think you could say he's metaphorically marooned by life. He's marooned himself on this island. And I think, there's a reason that desert islands are such fixtures in the popular imagination. We're terrified of them, and yet we're so drawn to them, attracted to them. You think of desert island discs. What 10 albums would you take on, if you were alone on a desert island? And, the scenario is presented as a kind of idyllic thing. All right, you're going to be by yourself, no distractions. You can really concentrate on these 10 albums or whatever it is, the 10 books. So it is a very strange place, and it holds in our imaginations. It has for hundreds and hundreds of years. I mean, you mentioned, Defoe and Robinson Crusoe. I think part of what made that story so gripping over the centuries is that factor and the questions that it draws out of people. Would I be able to survive? Would I go insane? Would I love it? Right?
How would you play the discs?
I know, yeah, I never really understood, yeah, how that would work. And yeah.
We're looking at this island, Santa Flora, but the world beyond Santa Flora is also, it's a bit ambiguous. We know Audie is from, quote unquote, the capital, and Central Pacific is mentioned. But other than that, we don't really get many hints about the state of the world. So talk to me about this decision to place everything at a remove.
Because it occurred to me as I was writing that when you have one human being and 3,000 goats, national identity doesn't matter a whole lot. In fact, it doesn't matter at all. In fact, his path, apart from, what we learn about his motivations for being there, isn't that important. It's the fact that he is simply this human being, and I hesitate to use the word everyman, but he is just a human being in a non-human environment. And I found that sort of liberating, actually, to write that way.
You mentioned that Audie has never had a pet, yet he begins to care for this endangered bird who he names E3. Can you talk a little bit about this relationship and how it unfolds?
Yeah, an extinct bird, actually.
I
At
didn't
one
want to
point,
spoil it.
yeah. Oh, yeah. Sorry. Yeah. It comes early enough. We
Yeah.
can probably do that. Well, Adi is on one of his first mornings on the island. He awakens to seven goats who are outside the hut that he has. It's an old sealer's hut on the island, and he's torn about what to do. His job is to shoot them. But it feels so deeply inhumane, is one word to say, sort of to slaughter visitors to your doorstep. And finally, he becomes so just enraged by his own inability to take any action that he sort of has a temper tantrum and chases them off into the mangroves. And there he finds on the ground a fluttering, he sees a fluttering of wings and picks up a small bird, light as an envelope, that clearly has a broken wing, and carries it back to his hut and doesn't know what to do except to begin caring for it. And he has a small, very small library of books that the Conservation Foundation that sent him there has equipped him with. And he goes looking through the book to find out what kind of bird this is. And it turns out it is a bird that was thought to have gone extinct in the 1980s. And the reason that the bird was thought to have gone extinct was because of the so-called invasive goats had decimated its habitat. And that fills him with a kind of renewed purpose to actually complete the mission he's been given. But of course, things get complicated.
You know, there are several moral dilemmas brought forth in the text. You know, eating meat that you've killed versus what you've purchased and wrapped in cellophane, eating meat at all, islands of trash in the oceans, ends of species. What did you want to explore with these topics, through Audie or just on their own?
You know, I called the book a fable because fables are an age-old genre of storytelling in which animals often stand in for human beings or for human dilemmas in stories that have some kind of moral dimensions. And, you know, as I explained the origins of the novel, it was always about the moral dimensions of this and the moral dimensions of human beings on this planet and even the dimensions of nature. You know, what is nature? Is nature just a construct that we humans have come up with to describe something that we think is separate from us, right? So the moral questions were always undergirding it. And anytime you start thinking about morality in terms of humans on this planet, you run into these moral dilemmas, and you run into our own, you know, ham-handedness in dealing with them.
Ron Charles reviewed Eradication for the Washington Post, and the first sentence of his review reads, "Jonathan Miles calls his new book a fable, but honestly, I think that's just to dodge the curse of calling it a novella." Was it your intention when writing this from the beginning that it was a fable, or is Ron Charles right?
Well, so it's funny because I've never really, and I don't think there is a hard and fast line between novellas and novels. I think it's like that line between fettuccine and linguine. One is just a little thicker than the other, but, you know, not sure they get measured, maybe in Italy. I always knew it was going to be a short novel. And there's a couple sort of things about that. I mean, partly every novel tends to claim its own amount of real estate, right? Some novels take up whole city blocks and some take up, like this one, small, narrow lots. But I also found my own reading habits influencing what I wanted to write, because ultimately I always am writing something I want to read. I mean, I'm my target audience. And I have been finding myself increasingly drawn to shorter novels. And I'm not alone in this. I don't think it's any surprise why. I mean, our attention spans are bombarded nowadays, right? It's almost like we go through our day with somebody tapping us on the shoulder every 30 seconds saying there's a breaking news and there's 50% off on dog toys and there's, you know, and so our attention span is so absolutely assaulted that I think it can be difficult for a writer to give the modern reader a doorstop of a book. And I say that as someone who has, you know, published doorstops. I wanted to reward readers with maybe who would be willing to give me 3 hours, 3 or 4 hours of focus and to fit as much life as I could into that 3 or 4 hours for them. And, you know, and early readers have mentioned to me that that they've read it in one sitting, which I take as a giant compliment because, you know, every cook likes to hear there were no leftovers.
I don't know if it was because it was presented to me as a fable, but I kept thinking like the tone and the point of view sort of, you know, reinforced that fable distinction. It sounded like it was a story being told to me of, you know, this, I don't know, a story that should have some sort of meaning to my life, maybe.
Mm. Yeah, I mean, I think the one area where I deviate a little bit from the fable tradition is that fables usually have a pretty explicit moral I left that to the reader. And so you know how it ends. You've read it. And partly that's because as a novelist, I start writing because I have questions. But I don't write novels to answer the questions. If I wanted to do that, I would write essays. That's what essays are for, right? It's more that novels are a way of broadening the questions, expanding the questions, multiplying them, giving them a face and a voice. Milan Kundera once wrote that novels teach us to comprehend the world as a question. The answer is the story itself. And what I want readers to take is the intensity of those questions and to have them see the face of those questions and hear the voice of them.
Well, the book is Eradication. Jonathan Miles, thank you so much for joining us again.
It's been an honor. Thank you.
Eradication by Jonathan Miles was published by Doubleday. Joining us now in the studio from right here in Wichita, Kansas, is Latasha Kelly, owner of Left on Red Bookstore. She's joining us with some book recommendations. Welcome to Marginalia, Tasha.
Thank you so much. Thank you for having me.
So what books would you like to talk about today?
Oh my goodness, there's so many. There's always so many on my TBR. But today I want to focus on the books that we are going to be reading for the Left on Red Book Club this year. So
oh,
it's
fun.
Actually Left on Red, the club.
Very
and
nice.
And we have 10 book picks for this year.
Oh, great. What's on the list?
So the first book is With Love from Harlem by Rashonda Tate, and hopefully I'm pronouncing Rashonda's name first name correctly, but it's With Love from Harlem, and it's a new release this year. This one is on the list because we were kicking off in February, which people associate with love and Valentine's Day, but also with Black History Month. And so I'm really not a huge romance reader, but I'm trying to do better because I do have customers that are super interested in romance, and I want to be able to give good recommendations. And so this is one that customers have been asking for me to pre-order, and it's historical fiction, romance, and so I felt like we were getting two for one. So we're able to touch on some of the history that's associated with the Harlem Renaissance and all the creation that came out of that, but also get a love story.
Oh, nice. Okay. What else do you have on your list?
Next, we have Erasure by Percival Everett. So I really wanted a Percival Everett book on the list, but I didn't want to do James because I know it's been done quite frequently. And so what's interesting is I was literally going through the shelves at Left on Red and just taking my time, picking out books, really reading the backs of the ones that I haven't read yet. And as I was reading the summary for this one, I was like, this sounds so familiar. And then it hit me, it's actually been turned into a movie, but the movie is called American Fiction.
Right.
I so enjoyed that movie and didn't put two and two together that it was based on a book. So that is why that is the second book. I'm really excited to, you know, the book is always better. So I'm excited to read it and kind of just, you know, compare.
It is fun to go back. You know, so many people will not see a movie until they've read the book.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's kind of nice to go back to see, since the book is always better, it's always nice to go back and read it and maybe fill in the holes where the movie got it wrong.
Right.
Okay. Yeah. What's next on your list?
Next, I have Happy Land by Dolan Perkins Valdez. And so this one is on the list because, one, the cover is beautiful. If I don't know if one of the categories for the ICT Reads Challenge this year has anything to do with flowers, but if it does, if you do have one of those on your reading challenge this year, Happy Land is the perfect book. It's beautiful. But I also chose it because I really struggle with listening to audiobooks. I think part of it may be my ADHD, but then I have friends who have ADHD and they say the opposite, that they are really able to get into them. I can listen to podcasts, like conversational podcasts, all day long, but to just sit and listen to the book, my mind is always straying. So anyway, I bring that up because this is the first audiobook, and I'm still listening to it, I'm not finished, but that I really was like, oh, it really sucked me in, and I was able to keep my focus much better than others. So yeah, so I thought that was significant because I usually just give up. So I'm excited to actually also read the physical book.
Yeah, I have not read that one, but I did interview her for Take My Hand.
Ooh, wow.
So yeah, this is one that I wouldn't mind picking up.
Yeah. Next, we have Successful Failure. It's by Kevin Fredericks, and his stage name is Kev on Stage. That's what most people know him as. Mm-hmm. And I love Kev on Stage. I have been following him since, some people may remember, he used to do Cartoon Scandal. And he would do, after an episode of Scandal, he would make like a cartoon version of the most significant parts, and it was hilarious. And from there, you know, he just continued working, and he's huge now. Like, he has his own studio, and he has shows on TV, all this stuff. But, so he has a book with his wife that came out some years back that's about marriage. And this one is talking about basically his entrepreneurship journey. And he often posts videos about doing it scared, not waiting until it's perfect to launch whatever, and, you know, just how, like, you'll think yourself out of starting something and having, you know these things, you hear these things, but to hear it coming from someone that you admire their journey and you have actually seen them put that into practice is really impactful. And so I'm an entrepreneur. And myself and some of my entrepreneur buddies were talking about possibly doing an entrepreneur book club, but we don't have the capacity to have multiple book clubs right now. So I figured I would put this one on the list to just kind of check a couple of boxes as well.
Yeah, sounds inspiring. What else is on the list this year?
So next we have Black AF History by Michael Harriet. And this is a collection of essays that is basically just telling the raw, you know, history of I won't say Black Americans, but the United States, I would say, and not sugarcoating anything. He also intertwines some humor in there because we're always going to find a way to laugh, even in some of the most challenging situations. But it's just a really right there in your face telling of our history. But I think he does it in a way that can be received by a wide audience. And I also really like the cover. Sometimes it's the cover that gets me. Yeah, so that's that one. And so something that I have that I was thinking a lot about as I picked the books and was thinking about launching the book club is that I didn't want it to turn into a situation where attendees of color are feeling like they have to educate other attendees of color. And I also didn't want the book club to be super heavy. So I was trying to find the right balance of absolutely, because we're all about amplifying Black voices and the Black experience, identifying some reads that would allow us to dig into that, but really set people up to be able to then carry on with their own research and reading beyond that, if that makes sense. So
yeah. Well, and I love the whole mix of genres you've selected as well.
Yeah.
It's not just you're not reading specifically for a genre.
Exactly.
Yeah. Okay.
Okay. The next one is Zeal by Morgan Jerkins. And this is actually another one that's checking off historical fiction and romance. So it is a love story from the post-Civil War era, and it takes you all the way to present day Harlem. So I haven't read this one. I'm looking forward to it.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. The next one is, this one I'm super excited about. So the next one is, I want to get the full title. Black Owned, The Revolutionary Life of the Black Bookstore by Shar Adams.
Mm.
So if anyone follows me, you may have seen a post where we posted a picture of that book and announced that we are in the book. The book released late 2025. And around the time that I was opening in November 2024, maybe some months in, I learned about these two books that were coming out about the history of Black bookstores. One was Prose to the People and one was Black Owned. And so in my mind, I just kind of assumed that because we were just opening, that there's no way that we would end up in any, either of them. And I was like, man. But I was like, you know, maybe version 2.0, the next edition. Mm-hmm. And so actually it was a customer that brought it to my attention because I had gotten the audiobook, and sometimes they have inserts that they'll attach. And so the insert had us up there. And I literally said, oh, that was nice of them. They like went back and did like an edited and updated version. And then a customer had reached out to me and was like, I'm so proud of you. And it seemed so random. And I was like, oh, well, thank you so much. And then she said, you know, I see you in the book. And that made us just super, super excited to just be listed among the ranks of some super, super powerhouse, I like to say OG, Black-owned bookstores that have really paved the way. So I'm excited to dig into this one. I also do want to do prose for the people that will likely be on next year's list. But Char is kind of coming at it, I believe, from more of a, you know, journalistic kind of perspective. The Prose for the People is a beautiful book, and it has a lot of images and just historical facts about the bookstores across the years. So two different types of books, but I'm excited to dig into both.
Oh, very nice. What a nice surprise that was to find you were in there.
Yeah. And it answered a question, because usually if I introduce myself or we're doing, somebody asks for our bio or whatever the case may be, I will say we are Wichita's indie Black-owned bookstore. But I had been reaching out to like the Chamber of Commerce and just different entities to find out, are there any other Black-owned bookstores in Kansas? Because I don't want to be saying we're the only one in Kansas, and that's not true. But we researched and researched and researched and couldn't find anything, and nobody really was able to direct us. And so I told my husband, I said, you know what? Let us just say it. I said, because I do believe that's the case. And I said, and trust me, if there is somebody else out there, they will let us know, and we will certainly, you know, give that acknowledgement. So far, so good. And so when the book came and I saw it, we are the only one listed, and I trust her journalistic research. So not to say that none will come after, because that would be great to have even more in Kansas, but currently we're the only. So it was just super exciting to be able to represent Wichita in that way.
I bet. Okay. So what's next on your list?
Okay. Next is Sky Full of Elephants. So that's a science fiction adventure which follows Black characters navigating a post-Earth diaspora, blending humor, action, and big questions about belonging and survival. And the main thing, and this isn't a spoiler, this is actually in the jacket, is that the people wake up one day and all the white people have passed away. And so I'll just leave it at that. But a lot of book clubs and book talkers that I follow have read this book and seem to, you know, enjoy it a lot. So I'm looking forward to it.
I love the title.
Yeah, me too. And it gets that science fiction.
Mm-hmm.
The next one is The Reformatory by Tananarive Due. It is a historical horror that's inspired by the real Florida School for Boys, and it blends supernatural elements with racial terror. I have heard nothing but rave reviews about this book, and I really have never gotten into horror before.
Mm-hmm.
So this will also be a new kind of genre for me.
Okay.
And then finally, we have The Rage of Dragons by Evan Winter, which is an epic fantasy rooted in African-inspired world building, following a young man driven by vengeance in a brutally stratified society. So this gets our fantasy in. So I really tried to get a little something across genres. And so I'm excited about that one, just because I read a lot of like self-help, true crime, murder mystery, which that might say something about me, but that's what I gravitate toward. So again, I'm just, this year for me is about expanding my horizons.
Okay, very nice. Well, you have given us so many books to think about. You can find all of Tasha's recommendations at kmuw.org. Thanks so much for being here.
Thank you so much for having me. This was fun.
Marginalia was produced at KMUW Wichita and is part of the NPR network. Our editors and producers for this week's show are Haley Krausen and Lou Ann Stevens. Torrin Anderson composed our theme music. This is Marginalia. I'm Beth Goldlay.
Maybe you already know about naked short selling. Maybe you've personally shorted stocks yourself. But do you know about the time short sellers ruined a Super Bowl, basically?
For me, I was a little late, but red flags went up like, what is going on? This is really scary.
At Planet Money, we get the story behind the money to explain how money works. Listen on the NPR app or wherever you get your podcasts.